You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Absolutely. Partly trolling, partly on the shore, partly in the deep. One of the things that I told you earlier when I promised we're going to hook up with Malloy Saboteur from the council is that one of the things that, we've already been looking at a lot is something called optimal yield. And, you know, those of you that are fishing may not think that that's important, but there's a lot of things that have been changed around a little bit. Malloy is here to explain them with regards to effort, time spent fishing, optimal yield, what can we fish, what can we get. It's not just load up the boat, grab some ice, and go take a chance. There are more people that want it a little more organized than that, and that's what the council is here for. That's why we guide you to go to wpcouncil.org, look up some of these things that we're talking about. And since we're towards the end of the year, a lot of the reportings have been done and the meetings have been held. So what the council is getting ready already is next year. And let's talk a little bit, Malloy, about optimal yield. What does that mean? I'm guessing it means what can you take from the fishery without damaging the fishery?
That is correct. So optimum yield is a concept brought up by the Magnuson-Stevens Act and the National Standard One, which are the rules that we abide by. And the council is required to specify what we call an optimum yield, which is, you know, the maximum amount that the fishery can take out of the ocean after you consider the social and the economic aspects of the fishery.
That's good to know. In other words, it's not just math. It's math, but you have to deduct or add need.
Right.
You know, because you said this, we've said this off the air a lot. A lot of the geography of the council is in places that are a lot more dependent on fish than they are, say, in the main Hawaiian Islands.
Right.
With regards to, if that family can't go fish, they don't eat.
That's correct.
You know? Okay, so when you talk about that, what defines optimal yield?
So, we talked about several times this science that we call a stock assessment, right? Mm-hmm. It gives you the maximum amount of fishing and also the maximum biomass that the fishery can take out of the ocean. Now, once you did away with the math, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. now you have to consider what are the social aspect of the fishery as well as the economic aspects of mm-hmm. the fishery. And once you know what those things are and account those information, then mm-hmm. you can determine, okay, what is the level of fishing that the fishery is allowed to take out of the ocean once you consider the whole gamut of information. And what's interesting about this concept is that once your fishery doesn't reach what that optimum yield level mm-hmm. is, like say you're down to like you're only harvesting 40% of what your optimum
what
yield
you could
is,
or what you should be allowed to,
right? Yeah. Or you're allowed to maximize your catch up to optimum yield, but mm-hmm. your capacity of your fishery is only up to 40% of that optimum mm-hmm. yield, for example. Then you can actually go into international agreements by which, you know, you allow foreign fishing to come in and buy that portion of that unused portion of that
optimum
yield.
Great example. And that's one of the things that I'm going to show you why this works and how important it is. You've heard us talk about this before, Malloy. That is, say, for instance, our Hawaii-based longline fleet does that on a regular basis. They go into areas where the optimal yield has not been reached. They pay the local area for the right to go and catch that fish. But yet it is, once again, restricted to that optimal yield. They can't just get an open sesame for going fishing. They're going fishing with a limit.
Well, the territories have this this quota on the international the international level, mm-hmm. right? So what that arrangement does is that it allows the Hawaii Long Line to access that quota that was assigned to the territory.
But like, not for free. They're paying for it.
They're paying for it, right. They pay for it. It's not technically optimum yield, mm-hmm. but it's the same concept where mm-hmm. you utilize a portion of that quota and you provide support to the territories that way.
Okay, now the support that Malloy is talking about, and this is another reason why we wanted to include that in part of this conversation here at the end of the year, is that that means that the money that you pay to get that, you know, that part of that quota doesn't necessarily mean that they're supposed to be able to go out and buy their own boat with that money and come and catch that fish. As a matter of fact, isn't most of the money diverted to other parts of the fishery?
Right. And the beauty of this arrangement is that the local government is allowed to utilize that fund in order for them to develop their fisheries. Not necessarily pelagic fishery or tuna fishery, but any kind of fishery development that they describe in their marine conservation plan.
And let me tell you, gang, that this is a wide group of fish. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons why we talk about this is we often talk on the program about the Deep Seven. And here in the main Hawaiian Islands, these zones that are kapu for fishing because they are, you know, considered to be the breeding grounds or the whatever, or for the stock. But what, Maloy, you were telling me off the air, that as an example, the bottom fishing, that there are areas in the council's realm that bottom fishing is just underutilized. I mean, not a little bit, but a lot.
Right. So the bottom fish fishery, we have bottom fish fishery here in Hawaii, the Deep Seven, and we also have bottom fish fishery in the territories.
Mm-hmm.
For Hawaii, the council recently recommended nymphs to set the catch limit at 492,000 pounds.
Okay. Now that is for the Deep Seven fish that we always talk about.
Right. Yeah. And then, given that on average, the annual catch for the Deep Seven is somewhere around 300 or a little bit lower than 300,000 pounds, mm-hmm. there is room in that quota,
mm-hmm.
That would, you know, that's underutilized. And the reason why it's underutilized is that, our bottom fish fleet here in Hawaii has probably already met its, you know, at like that flat level, mm-hmm. flat line.
Yeah, and by the way, that bottom fish fishery in Hawaii, the vessels are shrinking, not growing.
Right, you know? And participation has been going down over mm-hmm. the years, and, there's a lot of room for developing this fisheries and encouraging people to to catch Deep Seven bottom fish to contribute to our local economy.
What I think is amusing about that is, depending on who you talk to, whether they agree or don't agree with the stock assessments, I must tell you, and that part of you have learned here, and you can learn more at wpcouncil.org, the stock assessment procedure is way more accurate than it used to be. Thanks to technology and participation by you all, by fishermen, the numbers that the National Marine Fisheries Service gets, that NOAA gets, that the council gets, are a little bit more countable, more accurate than they used to be.
That's correct. And there has been a lot of effort to improve on the data, as well as to do research for life history, as well as doing some independent surveys using camera systems mm-hmm. to improve.
It's fantastic, yeah. Right. Because when you put a diver in the water, the fish scatter.
Mm-hmm.
When you put a camera in the water, after 2 seconds, the fish just swim by it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Yeah. You know, but I want to go back to make sure that people understand how you develop the bottom fish opportunity in other places. One of the things that you say that, first of all, that a lot of these places, even though they have the fish, they don't have a market for the fish.
Right.
They're just not. Why?
Well, they're in small islands like American Samoa or Guam and the CNMI, they have very limited markets. They don't have like the big Waikiki where we have like a huge demand from tourism. The Marianas, for example, has tourism in them, mainly coming from Southeast Asia. But there's very, very limited markets. And the flights are also limited where they couldn't do domestic trade for some of the fresh fish. And a lot of these areas are also importing fish from elsewhere, mm-hmm. which kind of suppresses the development of the local fishery, because it's easier to import marine products compared to like going out and catching it yourself.
Yeah, underlining specific species. There are a lot of things that are harder to catch. You know, we're going to talk about them later, like things like corner crab and deep water shrimp and some of the other stuff. It's not just anybody can go catch them. But what you're saying also is that even if the desire was there, if the market was there, at least at now, until more cash or more assets get breathed into that part of the geography, they don't have boats, they don't have equipment, and they don't have manpower.
Right. It's a significant investment to develop the fishery. And CNMI, for example, there is a huge interest in developing their fisheries there. CNMI is one of those areas that benefit from this fishing agreements, and the focus of their marine conservation plan is to develop the fisheries, particularly for bottom fish. And for that area, there's not a lot of boats, as well as most of their fishermen are actually contract workers.
Yeah, it's amazing. Huh?
Yeah, they bring fishermen from other areas to fish for their stores.
What I think is interesting is if you develop a sense of stock assessment that shows certain species, in this case the bottom seven or the deep seven, they might be a little different species wise in different places, but basically it's a half a dozen fish or so. If all of a sudden they could discover a market outside of their geography, now you're talking, right?
Right, and there has been some attempts to do domestic trade. Mm-hmm. There was, I think, a couple of years ago, there was an attempt to ship fresh bottom fish from Saipan to here through the United Fishing Agency, but I think that business only broke even.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was primarily because it was flying at all.
And
fish is heavy, right? Yeah,
and with very limited flights coming out of Saipan. Now it's down to like one flight a day, and it's hard to do domestic trade if you have limited access.
When we talked about this one time ago, then somebody came up to one of the fishers forum that I was emceeing and said, you know what? Since we know this, why don't they just catch the fish and freeze them? And then they can send them on a ship instead of send them in an airplane. And that makes sense, but isn't the value of the fish that is fresh?
The real beauty about
those fish,
our fisheries
anyway. Yeah.
are it's a fresh fish fishery, and we take pride in that fishery. But then again, you know, you got to compete. You got to run a business, and whatever works would get your business up to speed to whatever is the demand now. That's where you go.
Yeah, there's another point that we should cover as well, and that is a lot of times in these fisheries, like Malloy, you were just talking about, a lot of these guys are contract workers that are coming in because the young people in these areas aren't interested in working hard like their parents and grandparents did. They're looking for something else.
Right, and the generational changes and the generational gap, it's no longer backbone work where you enjoy hauling fish out of the ocean.
Yeah.
And now it's more, they're taking more of a college degrees and professional jobs, and so there's that generational gap that some groups are actually trying to reach out to the younger generation and start introducing different fishing methods and get them out in the water.
Well, what's happened here in Hawaii through the auspices of the council and others is intern programs where you can get young people in. And I'm pleasantly surprised. And as you all in the scientific end of the council must feel, it's great to see these young people coming up and doing the interest. When we do the Moanalua High School stuff, when we do some of these other things, isn't it somewhat, Malloy, like the restaurant business and the tourism business has really gone overboard to invite young local people to get into KCC or whatever and learn how to be a chef or a sous chef or a cook or something. And yet we don't see the same energy being expended to, why don't you come over here and get on this boat and go fishing with me?
Right, right. And that's also, some indirect ways of trying to revitalize the fishery is to establish the demand. So if this young generation of chefs are going to be using fresh fish out of the ocean, then the demand would increase, and therefore, would have more opportunities for existing or maybe entice other people to go out and supply that demand.
You know, I was talking to this one guy, and he's a regular listener. And as you know, we often have guys from Wicked Tuna on and Deadliest Catch and all this stuff. And they're saying, you know, my kid was looking at that and said, if I'm going to be a fisherman, I want to go fish over there. They make plenty of money. It looks that way. They don't really make plenty of money. They have a good reality show. But in fact is, when you go for those high-value species, sure, there's a lot more money. Isn't that why we have sometimes a lot of people at off-season redoing their longline boat and going somewhere else with it and catching something else?
Right. Yeah. And, you have to maximize the opportunities while you're in the water. And, most of those in-demand fish are most likely other people are also targeting those in-demand fish they want the easy money, right? But there are opportunities to explore other marine resources and see the marketability of those species, as well as see if the chefs are able to make use of some of those.
That's a good point. Matter of fact, let's go this route for a minute. First of all, when we talk about the council, we're talking about a lot of resources from the sea, precious corals, all kinds of things, not just things that we eat. But one of the things that we, when you see it on the local shows and stuff, everybody goes crazy over Kona crab and also deep water shrimp, both of which are not caught commercially in the ways it could be caught. I know that some of it was based on when you bring them up, like if there's, you know, the Kona crab, if it's female or if it's undersized, are we doing damage to this fish? Are they making it when they go back? What's the latest research show about the Kona crab, a resource? Is it plentiful? Is it being overfished? I would think no. Are there opportunities in Kona crab?
There are a lot of opportunities for Kona crab. The Science Center just did a revised stock assessment for Kona crab here in Hawaii. And the council also supported some research looking at, you know, how well do they survive once they're caught and some of the limbs break and then you throw them back, right? So what their assessment showed is very optimistic. I'm not going to break the, it's going to be released to the public.
I know it's coming up pretty soon, right?
In March. It just got reviewed last September. But the projections from that assessment shows that the stock for Kona crab is actually healthy.
A lot of people, Malloy, don't know what Kona crab is, though, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. One of the fishermen that attended the review said, younger generation don't even know what a Kona crab is.
And
they haven't seen Kona crab. And, you know, so now there's the challenge, right? The how do you market something that people are not familiar
with?
Yeah,
you know, if there's no demand, how do you market it? But interestingly enough, that's not always the case. Because a long time ago, pretty much everybody knew what Kona crab was, delicacy.
Right.
But there are fewer boats today.
Right. And there's very little commercial fishing happening for Kona crab, simply because of the over-regulation of this stock by that no take of female, which is a state statute, and also the minimum size. So it was estimated that almost 80% of what you caught, you have to throw back to regulatory.
And nobody
discard wants
to do that. Yeah.
Right. And, you can't maximize you cannot maximize to optimum yield if you're throwing back a ton of fish, even though the stock is healthy.
That's really a good point. I want people to get that. And I think the important part of it is that you either have to relax the rules to keep more of that catch, which would mean, I guess, less times down. If you get enough crab, you catch what you can, what your market bears. Is there a big difference between the male and the female?
There's a huge difference in terms of I forgot what the ratio is.
Well, I know they're bigger.
The females are bigger.
Yeah.
Right. And so in terms of ratio, on average, when a Kona crab fisherman would
when
go
you bring
out
up the net, what's in it or what's in the box? Right.
So I think it's there's more. It depends also on the site. So it varies, and also on the season. And the area.
A lot of
fish.
Variables, yeah.
So there's a lot of variables there. The ratio would differ based on those variables. So, but then again, you know, if you're gonna establish regulations, you have to make sure that it's based on science and not just I feel like, you know, the Kona crab is vulnerable, therefore I should protect the female.
I guess maybe one of the reasons why I wanted to ask you about that is I was watching just coincidentally last week on Deadliest Catch. These crab pots, I mean, it's unbelievable what they go through to catch those things, right? And you can tell when they dump them all out, they are sorted. These people can see the carpal length. They can see this with they don't have to measure it. They do it on the camera just for the, but they know that it's repetitive, right? And they throw back about a third. And those things, by study, has shown that they make it.
Right.
You know,
because you're only throwing a third of the. Now, in the case of Kona crab, you're throwing
it's more like
than
half
around 80%.
Oh my!
Because of the no take of female regulation and also the minimum size.
Right, the carpal size.
Yeah. So in that, but I believe the in deadliest catch, they're
it's only the size.
It's only size.
Yeah, and they can tell that just by a look.
Right. Yeah. So we have to revisit this regulation, especially if the stock is healthy.
What's amazing, I know you've seen it, and those of you that haven't seen it, it's called Deadliest Catch. You really ought to look it up. That and Wicked 2, and it's good fun to watch. When these crab pots come up, first of all, it's a miracle they can even get them because they sling the hook and the water's crazy. It's just a nightmare trying to harvest this stuff. But interestingly enough, there's very little mortality. These things get caught in the crab, right? I mean, in the pot, because there's a bait in it, fish head or something. So they all go in there. Once one, they fill them up. They can be 100 in that one catch, and of that 100, maybe 30 of them are small. But they put them right back in the water, and so it goes to show you when they come in how much tonnage they have. But that's for that crab. I mean, that's for those crabs. Do you ever see that the corner crab fishery could be a big one?
It has the potential to be, given the numbers that's being projected out of the assessment. It can be a viable fishery that can contribute to the local economy. The science is there, and we just have to make sure that the management is up to speed to that science, and we allow the fishery to develop and not be limited due to too much regulation. The other management unit species is the deep water shrimp.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's talk about this for a while. That and another one of my favorite, and that is munchong. The shrimp that you're talking about are where and how and what sort of sizes are we looking at?
So these are the in the markets what we call the ama ebi, and right now. There's NIMS has issued only one permit to fish for ama ebi, and these are two different species, Heterocarpus levigatus and Heterocarpus ensifer,
which we call one is called ama ebi, whatever.
So and there's only one vessel that's fitted to fish for this, and it's I believe they tell me that it's a seasonal fishery, and you know what's
just
interesting
so that people
that
know when you say it's deep water,
right? Yeah. It's in the open ocean, so you use traps to capture this MUS. But what's interesting is that there hasn't been a lot of studies being done on deep water shrimp. The last study or assessment that we've seen was still in the 80s.
Yeah.
So it's like long time ago. We have vast
open that was
ocean.
Before color TV. It was a long time ago.
There's a vast ocean resource out there that's waiting to be explored, waiting to be developed.
Here's the thing, Malloy. Everybody knows we all love shrimp, but sometimes shrimp comes from questionable places. And, what looks like in a package looks like nice shrimp may or may not be. Mm-hmm. I do know that it's very, very controlled, but that, you can get sick really quick from certain things.
Right.
And some of those shrimp that come in from places where they're captured is pretty suspect water. And we know that shrimp really basically eat rubbish, right? They're on the bottom.
Yeah. In this case, these are like
shellfish.
These are mostly mesopelagic. Mm-hmm. Species and we're in the Hawaii is in the middle of one of the most pristine waters out there, and we're isolated, and although we hear about this garbage patch flowing ending up in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, but relatively speaking, I mean, we're isolated from it's not these are not cultured species. There are these are wild shrimp out there that can be used to supply local demand.
What, for those that don't know, where do they fit? I mean, we know that there's lots of them. We got to identify the places that they are. But in the food chain, where are they? Obviously, they're food. Anytime you have any animal, it's food.
Right.
So one would imagine that all bottom dwellers are shrimp eaters or crab eaters if they can find them.
So this is probably like primary I don't know, like a omnivore, where it's not at the bottom of the food chain, but a couple of levels above.
But it's pertinently important, so that when they do a stock assessment, if you were to say go in and take, like in some places where they're farmed, it doesn't matter. But in some places where they're taking the resources out of the ocean right there, there is no more stock left.
And that's really a good point. And you know, that's why we need to have we need to have research to determine okay, where they're at, when, how often do they boom in terms of population, and when do they shrink, and also look at the ecosystem effects.
Yeah.
Once you harvest this lacus, these are going to be food source for fish and other higher level predators. And how does that trickle down the food chain?
Yeah, that's a great point. And quite often science will say, look, if you've got these three or four different levels, and the one in the middle is, let's say, the shrimp, that a bunch of things above it are eating it, and a bunch of things below it, it's eating. If you take any one of these out of the mix, the whole chain can collapse.
Well, not necessarily collapse, but it's more
certainly
of like
there's
going to be some imbalance to some extent. Highlight the point that, you know, there's a lot of connectivity in terms of the linkages between the different species, in terms of food and energy dynamics. It's not just a one single straight line where if you remove one part, everything just collapses.
But you know what we ought to do is we ought to take a break and then go eat some shrimp and then come back, because you've hit on my favorite subject. Now, there's another thing, and there's a couple of things, gang. We have come to really appreciate certain species of late. And really, these used to be, in the particular, first of all, with OPA, they were bycatch, right? I mean, we are all of a sudden seeing a lot of OPA in the market, and it's a great fish. I mean, the chefs love it. It's a really good eating fish. It's a real mystery, though, isn't it? First of all, it's really weird looking. Mm-hmm. And secondly, where did we first start catching them? I'm guessing that they were part of the bycatch on the longline fleet.
They are. Mm-hmm. They are a bycatch of the longline fleet, and there has been some efforts to encourage chef and restaurants to use this bycatch species.
Yeah, it's wonderful species.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently there's, based on studies, there's six species of OPA.
Yeah.
So I've seen
like three, and they're different dots and they're different size eye. They all look the same, right? It's like aquawood.
Almost.
It's like a lot of the tunas.
Yeah.
But once you know, can you target them specifically? I would guess geographically, yes, you could.
Probably that way, or depends on the depth where each of those species are distributed, or, you know. So there are various ways to know where. Then again, we need to have the research to do.
Have you, like me, at the auction, marveled at the way people look at these things? And they're just so beautiful. You know, I mean, first of all, they're so ugly, they're beautiful. Let's put it that way. Because they really are a strange-looking fish. But by the same token, it used to be, I guess, that what would happen is the long line would be bringing in the long liner. And if they have something that's no good, they got to cut it loose or let it go, or they do. And now, by creating the ban, that OPA can get a pretty good price. People are starting to realize how valuable it is.
Yeah, and it's good. It's a good white meat fish. And you know, whenever there's OPA in the restaurant, I make sure that.
Oh, me too. I always order it. Me too.
Yeah, you can't let that opportunity slip.
Now let's talk about another fish, and I'm not sure whether we should make the bottom seven, the Magnificent Seven, become the Magnificent Eight or what. But you've seen a lot lately, more lately, showing up at the auction, the Munchong. And the Munchong is an interesting fish, because at first when you see it, it's a blackfish, and you don't realize what the meat is. But the Munchong is absolutely another one of these. It's a delicacy, you know, and where do we stand? I do know that you're keeping some pretty good records. What's happening with that fishery? Are there opportunities there?
That's another species that starting to emerge a fishery that can be developed. I know there were some projects that was submitted to the Sultan Stall Kennedy to develop the fishery for Munchong, because we have that particular species that you mentioned that's really good eating. And you know, that's unfortunately, there's not a lot of data for Munchong It's one of those fish that are probably caught in the recreational fishery, bottom fish.
Yep.
And also, almost.
By the way, I got to tell you, the people rave about it. I got this one friend of mine whose parents own a small market, and they have this one fisherman that catches moonchong, and they beg him because they got their customers asking, "Hey, when are you going to have more moonchong?"
Yeah. And I know they're in Guam. Some of our advisors who are like commercial fishermen, they're also trying to develop the market for moonchong in Guam.
I think one of the main reasons for that is that it's size-wise, it's a manageable fish, you know, and there's certain things to be said for trackability, mobility, shipping and display and a lot of other things. When you look at them in a chiller, if you see a moonchong and an opa side by side, you say, wow. I mean, are these the same? I mean, they're certainly not. But the market must be there. It seems to me that it has been developing a little bit because you do see it at the auction quite a bit.
Yeah, and the goal here is now to find appropriate channels to market this fish. And we encourage hotels and restaurants.
You chefs want to come up with something good.
They're really an important piece to this fishery development because we gotta establish that demand for this species.
You know, somebody else once told me, and gang, you can find out what me and Malloy are talking about and many, many other things. It's a great resource for you to go to wpcouncil.org and check things out. wpcouncil.org. One thing I was learning from a friend who's a chef at Roy's at the Eating House in International Marketplace, he said what's happening is, as a result of so many young chefs realizing the opportunities there are, and so many ways creatively our local fishery is being used, more people are going out to eat than ever. And so that if anything, these markets would be increasing the demand for fresh local fish, because even when you pay the quote price at a restaurant, you still get a good value.
And this is the, this is a unique market for not only for local consumers, but also for the tourists who wanted to experience eating opa.
I love to see when you go through the chicken dishes on the menu, there's 30. You know, when you go through the meat, there's 30. When you go for the fish, there's 2. When it could be many, many, many. Here's another thing that I think it might be important. You know, we're generating a lot more interest in the cooking and everything else. But also there's a lot of concerns about safety. And I do know that the auction particularly is really careful of the fish that they bring in. And I do know that this is the holidays. So I got a couple of questions on that. First of all, based on the last couple of years, it looks like at this point, knock on wood, it's early enough to say that there's going to be ahi, the big guy is pretty good. We're catching the loads are coming in pretty well this year.
Right.
Yeah.
And also, it's also going to be New Year where you need to have the redfish.
Oh, got to have it. Yeah. And that's another thing.
Opa is a redfish.
Yep. And just as a reminder. But there is another thing, and that's the value, particularly a lot of families, Malloy, they like that big onago on the table. You know, they see that big redfish. That means they've had a pretty good year. Basically, that is kind of wraps things up. I do know that one of the things that we're looking for is when somebody hears something that sounds interesting, I guess that what now some people are looking for is, okay, if we develop an interest or we want to be an entrepreneur, if there's an opening in the marketplace for, say, moonchong fishing, and we'll supply we have the collateral, we have the money, we don't have the expertise, how can we find more people that are willing to invest in the fishery so that they can hire more of us to fish the boats?
So that would entail the collaboration between what we call it's either private partnership or private public partnership, and we need to have those partnerships in order for us to work together and develop this some of this underutilized resources so that we can contribute to food security as well as to the local economy.
Yeah, that's a great point. So basically, all in all, if you and I don't get a chance between now and the end of the year, we've actually had a pretty good year. I think maybe some of the major accomplishments of the council that people can go look at wpcouncil.org. If you were to be asked one thing about some of the things that you've been involved in this year where you've seen a good amount of progress, what would it be?
That would be, gonna be biased on this with regards to this answer, since I'm a scientist.
Then yeah, I like this part of what you're gonna say.
And this is it's the improvement in the way the science has been generated in our region, and also the improvements in the data that we collect. Well, that's one of the success stories that we have this year is a revised a revised deep seven bottomfish stock assessment and a revised Kona crab stock assessment.
I'll tell you why I asked. And it's because when I get asked by people that listen to the program, you know, why do you all do this program? It's an educational thing that the council does, because a lot of people before we started doing this thought the council was, oh yeah, that's the longline guys. And when you no. We're from the base of the shore with the DLNR all the way out.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it's, you know, although the longline is our primary big fishery, we do work with local communities and the state of Hawaii in managing other resources as well.
I hope you have a great holiday season. Look forward to seeing you again, Maloy. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Okay, and listen, my gang, if you want to hear something on the show, it is incredibly easy. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. And if you really want to get an eyeful of information and see a real good website, they've done great work at the WP Council's website, wpcouncil.org, wpcouncil.org. Hope you have a great rest of your Thanksgiving weekend. We'll see you next week for another episode of Go Fish right here.